Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Octopulse, our Detroit News, Detroit Red Wings podcast. I'm Mark Faulkner, Detroit News Assistant Sports Editor, along with Ted Colfin, our Red Wings beat reporter. Later in the podcast, we'll hear from Hockey Hall of Famer Pat LaFontaine, who will pay tribute to his former CompuWare coach, Réal Turcotte, who passed away last month at age 79. That story was in Tuesday's paper, and you can find it online at DetroitNews.com. But first, Ted, let's take a look at a story that you wrote about the Red Wings and the new collective bargaining agreement and why General Manager Steve Yzerman is ideally suited to add players that other teams can't afford. The new CBA and the return to play agreement. Ted, you've covered work stoppages in 2004, 2012, different times, different circumstances, but this was done relatively quickly in these uncertain times. Did it surprise you?
Somewhat, Mark, but I guess it, you know, speaks to the level of tranquility out there right now, and I think both sides obviously wanted to get something done, and it's nice to know that we will have labor peace for, what is it, I think 5 or 6 years here going forward. The Wings are well positioned. Whether they take advantage of it, well, we'll have to wait and see, but with the salary cap stagnant here for a good couple years, you're going to see some teams really up against it. It's the teams that you would think, the teams that are the contenders, the Tampas, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, I believe Toronto's definitely in that category. They're going to need to lop off some salary. I mean, there's just no two ways around it. I don't see how otherwise they're going to be able to exist with their present rosters. They will have to make way with, they're going to have to lop off some, you know, fairly high priced veterans. And in that vein, yeah, the Wings should be able, are able to add some salary if they so desired. There probably will be some good players on the market there that, you know, probably better than you would see on the free agent market this summer. So it's something definitely to keep an eye on.
Well, let's begin and let's really focus then on one team, Yzerman's former team, the Lightning. It was a year ago at this time, the Lightning were coming off that 62-win season, and they were about to be swept by the Blue Jackets. And Yzerman and assistant GM Julien Brisebois looked at each other and knew they would never win a Stanley Cup together in Tampa Bay. Now, last year, Yzerman acquired a player that he drafted in Tampa Bay, Adam Ernie, for a fourth-round pick. And, Ted, you identified three or four players who could be available. Andre Palat, two more years left, career-high 17 goals. Probably unlikely he would be a player that Brisebois would want to move. He makes $5.3 million. The next two players were undrafted players, 5'9", Yanni Gourde. He's making $5.1 million for five more years. And then there's Tyler Johnson.
That is quite the generous contract, I tell you. When I saw that one, that is one that really stood out. That's going to be an albatross for them for a long time.
Now, would Steve Yzerman be interested in Gourde, a 5'9" center? Again, 4 years in the minors. He's got this long contract. What are your thoughts about Yanni Gourde? Because another player just like him is Tyler Johnson, who Red Wing fans remember in the playoffs. He's been a Red Wings killer in the postseason. Johnson has 51 career points in 68 playoff games. He makes $5 million a year, four more years left. He's 5'8". So between those two players, Ted, Gourde and Johnson, do you think Steve Yzerman would have a preference there if it's possible the Lightning win the Cup and these players have a lot more value too?
Yes. And another thing is, Mark, I mean, Yzerman's been very adamant about how he's not going to want to be tied into having salary cap problems going forward. He doesn't want to he doesn't want any long-term big money deals. At least he said so in free, as far in terms of free agency. Mm-hmm. So you wonder if, you know, Tyler Johnson, 4 more years at that type of money.
Right.
And he's pushing 30. I'm pretty sure he's in that 28 to 31 range. Not having a good season thus far. I mean, we'll see what happens in the playoffs. But in one vein, sure. I mean, they could definitely add a guy like him or a Gurdy who, like we said before, I mean, that was just you wonder what Brisbois was thinking there. That was a very generous contract for a very unproven player. But, I mean, yeah, the Wings, if they so desire, they'll be in position to get one of those guys or an Alex Killorn. Mm-hmm. He's having a career year this year, but again, you know, good player in Tampa. You wonder, would he be a good fit here or not, with very much less talent around here than he does have in Tampa. But yeah, they'll be in position to add the team that really that I'd like to keep an eye on, I think, is Pittsburgh with those two goalies. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously the Red Wings will need a goaltending. You know, they'll need goaltending in this offseason. Either one of those two, Matt Murray, who's won 2 Stanley Cups for the Penguins, or the young Tristan Jarry. I mean, I think either one of those two would look good in a Red Wings uniform and probably wouldn't have to give up a heck of a lot to get them because of the salary cap and all.
That is interesting too, Ted, about the goaltending. That's right. So you're probably not going to get
I think they'd Askarov. Go more for a goal. Yeah, I think they'd more go more toward a goaltending than they had another forward. But, I mean, those options are going to be available. Yeah.
And ironically, Matt Murray, 2012, the Wings had a chance to take him. There were 7 goalies off the board, including Yzerman, who took Vasilevsky, 19th overall in the first round. And the Wings had a choice between Matt Murray, Frederik Andersen with Frölunda, really good goalie, Matt Murray in the Sioux, and Jake Patterson in Saginaw. And the Wings took Patterson, and then a couple of picks later, the Penguins took Murray, and he won those 2 Stanley Cups. So, yes, that might be a player that Jimmy Rutherford says, I might move him and stick with Tristan Jarry.
Yeah, Jarry had a very good year this year, too.
Yeah.
We'll see. That's going to be interesting team to watch in the playoffs here, which direction they'll go with. Will they go with Jarry or Murray? But that's something we can talk about next week. But, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see – it's unlikely they'll keep both of them, so one of them's going to have to go.
And, Ted, just one final thought about the Lightning, looking at their pay grade and how they align their salaries. Kucherov's at 9.5, Stamkos 8.5, Braden Point 6.75, Victor Hedman at only 7.8. They've got to sign Cirelli, Sergachev. They have good deals for Coleman and Goodrow. And Vasilevsky goes from 3.5 to 9.5 next year. So my question would be, too, when Steve Yzerman now starts to slot players behind Dylan Larkin, who makes like $6.5 million, it's interesting, isn't it, down the road? This is what the Wings, ideally, the position they want to be in. Yeah.
Yeah, Mark, they're a long way from that, though, my friend. They are a long way from that.
Yeah, no kidding.
They don't have to worry about that problem for a long time. But it will be interesting to see how much of how big of a slice of the pie they give to both Anthony Mantha and Tyler Bertuzzi this year. Those are Mantha specifically. I mean, that's going to be an interesting negotiation. I mean, he could command some pretty good money. I mean, his stats are comparable to some of the younger stars around the league. So that will be an interesting contract negotiation to watch.
Yeah, and a lot of people, Ted, are wondering who is going to sign first in this new market with the cap sort of stagnant over the first few years. Will Mantha make as much as he would normally make, $8 million or more, or will he be down just above Dylan Larkin as well? So I think a lot of teams are waiting to see what happens first. So
that
wraps up the first part of our podcast. Let's go now to our interview with Pat LaFontaine. Joining us now is Pat LaFontaine, a Hockey Hall of Famer who played 15 years in the NHL with the New York Islanders, Buffalo Sabres, and New York Rangers. 865 career games, 468 goals, 1,013 points before post-concussion syndrome, forced your retirement at age 34. Pat, at age 16, you played here in Michigan with the 1981-82 Detroit CompuWare team, coached by Riel Turcotte, who was a pioneer in developing hockey schools, hockey skills as well, like stick handling and playing with and without the puck. In fact, you said, Pat, he opened the doors for a lot of young American hockey players, especially after the Miracle on Ice Olympic team in 1980. What did Riel Turcotte mean to your career?
Well, and first, Mark, thanks for having me. And, you know, Riel was just, he was a legend in the area. He impacted so many young players' hockey careers, including myself and my brother. And, you know, that year we played together. He was the coach with my dad, probably the first CompuWare team, because Pete Karmanis was the manager, and Pete's son, Pete Jr., played on that team. We had, I think, 7 players from that midget team get drafted in the pros, and 4 ended up playing. Ally Afraidy was one of them. Obviously, Alfie Turcotte, Real's son, Jeff Rolichek, myself were all drafted pros. And then I believe another 4 guys played D1. It was a special team, but Real was, you know, such a presence at teaching skills, the skills of the game, especially stick handling, the Gordie Howe move, the different moves that, and then we all worked the hockey schools in the summer together. You know, some of my greatest childhood memories were working the hockey schools, playing hockey, and that midget team with Alfie and his dad Rael, and my dad coaching, and we ended up, I think it was 2 centermen and 3 lines, and we would alternate centers, and it was just an amazing team. But it was all the years leading up to that team, you know, the hockey schools and the skills. And Rael, you know, Rael had a background, you know, with his French-Canadian background and his years of playing hockey. My dad played hockey for a little while, but, you know, Rael brought that that expertise. You know, I don't think I ever remembered him not excited to see or be on the ice. He had this huge smile. He lit up a room, and he, you know, was just full of passion, and it resonated with all of us. And he made learning hockey fun. He made teaching the game fun. And you know, at the end of the day, when you're playing this game, and there's so many things about the game that you look back at, even when you retire and let go, the game lives on inside of you long afterwards. So the life skills, the relationships, the character development. And if you're having a positive experience at every age, which is age appropriate experience, yeah. you develop an emotional connection. And Rael had a way of making the game fun. I actually use the term wrap it in cheese, because if you give a dog a pill, he'll spit it out. But if you wrap it in cheese, he doesn't even know he ate it. And so if you're making it fun, and then you're working hard, but you're enjoying what you're doing, and you're having a positive experience, you know, an hour later, you're sweating and you're wiped out, and you're like, wow, that was amazing. And you don't even know, you kind of jokingly ate the pill and did all the hard work and sacrifice for the game. So Rael had a way about him, and I think what was exciting about that 1980-81 CompuWare midget team that won the that actually we won a ton of tournaments. We ended up playing against Chicago in the final game. We were about 79-2. We had a lot of fun, and my dad and Rael were a good balance. And then, you know, then Pete Karmanis was our manager. I mean, who would have thought years later what transpired from that one team and that coaching? But Rael just did a tremendous job. Super, super smart in the hockey sense. And then the full package was just teaching the skills of the game. And it impacted all of us.
You mentioned Ally Afraidy earlier. I remember watching Ally Afraidy back in 81 or 82 in warm-up. He won the hardest shot 5 times in the NHL skills competition. He was pounding the puck off the boards in warm-up, and I was there with a former NHL linesman, Bill Clements, who said, Mark, you got to see this team. And when he saw Iafredi with that 100-mile-an-hour slap shot going off the board, he goes, I think he's doing that on purpose, scaring the other team. And, you know, that's a memory that I remember. I also remember, Pat, meeting Real Turcotte when Compuware and Peter Carmona spot the Windsor Spitfires in the early 80s. And you're right, he was this whirlwind of ideas, energy, so passionate about developing skills. And one time, he talked about the importance of the lower hand on your stick, moving that lower hand all the time, depending on the circumstances. I didn't know what he meant, and I'm sure there wasn't anything specific that he taught you, other than Alfie said that sometimes his dad would see skaters like skate for 20 minutes in circles without the puck. Alfie said his dad wanted you guys to touch the puck. So what specifically do you think he might have taught you guys that at the time it wasn't revolutionary, but it was certainly an emphasis on skill development?
Well, yeah. And it's interesting. You talked about his passion and his creativity and his excitement.
Yeah.
You know, there's very few people in the world you could say that never have a bad word to say about somebody. And Raul was that one of those guys. He was a gentleman, and everybody he met, he introduced himself with passion and kindness, and never had a bad word to say. And everybody just loved Raul. He just had a way about him. And so I think what made Raul special was his communication skills and his ability to break down the moves on the stick handling, to break down the plays on the ice, and to show you that you just can't do this. You need to do this step first, then you need to do this step, and then you need to pull the puck over to as wide as you can go. And the reason why he would show you, and so he would break down everything, and then it was, okay, learn how to do this first, push the puck forward, then slide it back, then slide it over, and as you're sliding it over, yeah, you know, spread your legs and push with this side, and then lean into so the guy can't, you know, you can protect the puck. And so it was basically simulating what happens in a quick second. He would break down in four different or five different spots in areas, and then you would just practice each one of those, and then seamlessly after you did it, you know, in repetition,
right,
it became natural. And so I think what Raul was really good at teaching was really simplifying it, breaking it down, working on the individual moves that then collectively made into this one move. And so when you see players do something unique, you know, it's a lot of repetition, a lot of practice, a lot of breaking down, but it looks like it's one move. And Raul was able to kind of, you know, break that down. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that I remember most people couldn't understand and coach and teach that. And then the other thing is if you really think about a game,
sure,
we were doing, you know, statistics on how many times a player actually touches, how many seconds. It's not uncommon in a 60-minute game that a player might have the puck in their control for 20 seconds, no longer than a minute for the whole game.
Sure.
If you really think about it, because you're moving the puck, you're passing the puck, you're stick handling, how many times do you actually have that puck? And then when you have that puck on your stick, it's critical because it kind of controls the dictates what's going to happen next. And so what Raul would do is it had to become second nature, you know, and learning how to stick handle with your head up. And so the thing is if a lot of players, you know, would always be looking down.
Sure.
And yeah, this is something my dad always taught was, you know, work on your weaknesses. And it was natural to look down because it was second. It didn't feel second nature to stick handle. Raul made it, and my dad, by teaching the weaknesses, Raul made it so that it just becomes so natural having the puck on your stick that everything else, you could see the play, you could make smarter reads, you could make better passes, and it became just second nature. And I think the repetition of practice and breaking down plays, it sounds simple, but
yeah, right,
it translated into skills and development over a period of time. I mean, look at the players, where the players ended up and evolved to. So, you know, we're very fortunate. And I know Alfie and I spoke about this, when Raul passed away, you know, how we were all impacted by his genius and his love of the sport and how he was able to teach us so much.
Alfie also said that some people would criticize his dad, saying he produced a bunch of puck hogs because you guys had the puck all the time. But there was a lot of passing. I know that final year, or at least in 79 games, you had 175 goals, 149 assists, 324 points. You said you had two centers and you guys were like rotating and things. Was there ever any downside like to what he was teaching you guys? Was there ever any pushback? Because here was this American team right after, you know, the Olympic medal, as I mentioned off the top, that was playing as well as Canadian teams. And at the time, I think, Pat, it was a new wave of hockey being taught over here in the States.
I would say to you that team was really kind of a stepping stone, maybe even a foundation for a lot of teams and players to come. Because what happened was, you know, we had heard things about Canada and junior hockey, and we had heard things about college. And, you know, I was very fortunate to play local up till I was 15. I mean, I played right there at Waterford, Lakeland Arena. You know, I played for sponsored teams, Richardson's Farm Dairy, who owned the rink at the time. And then, you know, we had Audubon Motors. One of my uncles was involved with them. And then we had Kentucky Fried Chicken. So I played all these local teams. And then I really didn't play real travel teams outside of the local area until I was 16. And, you know, that team started out 60 and up. And the talent and the hard work and the skating and the passing and all of it kind of just gelled together. And we would go in and play teams, and it just clicked. I mean, it wasn't uncommon. We had the two centermen, Alfie and myself, rotating with three different lines. And I believe we just had six set of defensemen, and we had great goaltending. And we ended up going up into Canada and started playing in these tournaments. And by the end of the tournament, the stands were packed. Who are these Americans? And it was ironic, was, you know, we followed right after the 1980 Olympic team. So here it was that, you know, this great Olympics that opened the door for so many young boys and girls that, you know, started to dream bigger within hockey. And then comes this, you know, midget AAA Compuware team that's just, you know, winning all these tournaments and just really making a name for itself. And really, between the Olympics kind of opening the doors and putting the spotlight, and that midget team that just, you know, started creating a lot of buzz, and then obviously, you know, seven kids from that team get drafted into the pros, that was unheard of from a midget hockey team in the United States. So if you look at the architect and the coaching between Ral and my father and Pete Karmanis, it's not surprising the success that team had, that, you know, then players went on to play pro. You know, what was great was, you know, Alfie's dad stuck in the grassroots, stuck with right. the kids and worked the hockey schools and just continued to teach the grassroots level and the next generation. And I give him so much credit, because all the other players, and then here's Pete Karmanos, who went on, Bart bought the Hartford franchise, moved it to Carolina, won a Stanley Cup. And so, you know, it really stems. And people ask me, you know, what gave you the confidence then to go to play junior and Olympics and then go on to play pro? The foundation of that team, you know, I played up with my brother. My brother and I were very fortunate. We played together our whole careers. And then he was older for that midget team. I ended up playing the first year at my age level. And that team gave a lot of players tremendous confidence to believe and dream bigger, and the confidence to go to those next levels. And so the architects of that were really Real Turcotte, my dad, Real Turcotte, and Pete Karmanos. Sure. And, yeah. And we, you know, you look back as young players, and I think a lot of people do this in their lifetime. And there are, and I always say, there are three mentors in your life. There's your parents, there's your coaches, and there's your teachers. And they have major impacts on your life and your trajectory of confidence and where you go and the life skills and the character development. And we, you know, Alfie and I reminisced, you know, when his dad had passed, that, you know, how blessed and how fortunate we were, and anybody who came across, you know, Real during that time and learned. And then the hockey schools alone, my brother went on, we all worked them, and he went on to do his school. And, you know, so you just spread the word and you spread the talent and the learning and the teaching to create, you know, more players. But I think the most important thing was really the character development and the life skills that we learned from, you know, the mentoring and from those experiences.
Pat, two final questions. How much did you know about Riel's hockey background? In the 1950s, NHL teams owned your rights, so he was claimed by Montreal like at age 14. He played for the Hall Ottawa Juniors, eventually turned down a contract, Alfie said, for $12,000 when he could make $14,000 teaching. He coached a team called the Lansing Lancers in the IHL. He studied math at Michigan State, played senior hockey back in Montreal. Alfie said when they went out to Nanaimo, his dad sold him to Portland for $25,000 and four players. And he said his mom was really upset that, you know, Riel would sell him to pay bills with Nanaimo. So that's kind of funny stuff. But did you know much about this gentleman who had such a profound effect on so many people's lives?
Yeah, you know, I didn't know most of that. And I did forget to mention that he did, as Alfie was evolving, he did go on and do coaching at a little bit higher levels and spent most of his career and most of his time kind of at the grassroots and hockey school and teaching. But during Alfie's time, my brother played with them in Nanaimo when Riel was out there coaching. So we have a strong connection, and that's something I'm sure he can share with you. But here's another irony, how our career paths had crossed, that we played on that midget team. I went up to Verdun and played in Montreal, and then Alfie went on and played in Nanaimo. And that was a strategic deal that his dad made, because Alfie then went to the Memorial Cup with Portland and Cam Neely. And Verdun, we won the President's Cup in the Quebec League, and we ended up meeting in Portland against each other, playing junior hockey, and the Portland Winterhawks won the Memorial Cup that year. And, you know, I talked to Cam about it a lot, but Alfie was there. I believe it was Randy Heath. They had a super team. Oshawa was there, and it was Lethbridge, I believe, the four teams. But you're talking about 1982, 83. And so it was only a year later that we met, you know, after playing our midget careers. But that was a strategic, smart deal that his dad was able to get him to Portland. He was going to the Memorial Cup, and they won it. And that's the kind of things, you know, dads did. Listen, they sacrificed, and you want to give your kids, you know, everything and the tools to kind of go forward. But Riel did that with everybody. And you know, Alfie had some great professional experiences, drafted by Montreal, and played. I mean, you just had to look at Alfie one time come up the ice, and you knew he was a special player. And Riel had so much to do with that. And Jeff is a tremendous player also. Mm-hmm. And they all followed kind of in their footsteps. And here you are now. What a great thing to watch his grandson get drafted. I was so happy to know and see him there when he saw his grandson Alex get drafted by LA. So it came full circle. And you know, he was an amazing man who gave back to so many. But I know, you know, for somebody who's probably – you know, talked about stick handling, and they called you mentioned the word puck hogs, but at the end of the day, Riel wasn't about the stick. He was about the stick hand, but he wasn't about so much the scoring. He was about the assist, because in the game of life, it's not about scoring goals. It's about assists. He assisted and so many players and impacted so many players. And to see probably it go to a third generation in his grandson before he passed had to be extremely meaningful for him after all he's, you know, done for the game of hockey.
And finally, Pat, I asked Alfie if he was surprised that his dad's death didn't receive more media attention. And I said, you know, your dad really wasn't quiet or reserved. He goes, oh, no. He said he was the boss and he was firm but fair. And he said he built all those hockey schools and he had to standardize the quality of the coaching, the rules and regulations. And Alfie said it was kind of fitting at the end of the obit, the last line said, practice your moves 10 minutes a day. So is there a reason why perhaps that his death, perhaps maybe a lot of people didn't know about it? Or do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Honestly, Mark, I think it was the time. I think we were going through extremely scary times with what's happened in our world with COVID. And I think Riel was very humble. Mm-hmm. Riel was one that would rather take a back seat and, you know, like I said, pass the puck and watch somebody else score their goals. And Riel probably took, he took so much more enjoyment out of watching all of the players that he had been a part of go on and become successful, not only on the ice, but off the ice. So I think that if you look back to probably, you know, he has so many great, great parts to his legacy. The thing that I'll remember the most, if you had to say the foremost skill teaching early on, especially stick handling, you know, he would be the Mount Rushmore of that. Nowadays, parents, and, you know, whether it's in any sport, particular hockey, they're hiring, you know, skill teaching coaches. Rao was way ahead of his time. He started it. He implemented really the skill set teaching, and you know, he left so much behind as far as how he impacted the game. But I would say to put one spotlight on, outside of the person and the man he was and the gentleman that he was, I really didn't understand the art of stick handling and the value of learning how to feel like that puck was second nature and how to roll your wrist, how to keep your head up. Yeah. That in itself is such an impact to an overall player's success because of the confidence it gives you. But he was at the forefront of bringing that to the sport. And I think in this country and really putting a spotlight on it. And then his hockey schools will be part of the legacy of, you know, just so many kids were at Rel's Turcotte's Stick Handling Hockey School and probably saw all of us, you know, as, you know, helping out and as assistant coaches and supporting it. But I think that it was really just the time. I mean, we're here in New York and we were getting at the epicenter, we were getting decimated during these times. And there was another young, great, great young player, Jack Bocas, who was all a part. It was the LaFontaine kids, it was the Turcotte kids and the Bocases. And Jack just recently passed from cancer and coached for over 30 years with the LA Kings junior program. And I know he's very close with Jeff, one of Jeff's best friend. And I saw them both out in Anaheim and just recently. So, you know, God bless Jack and Ral. And we had one more recent that was a coach, was Asa Smith. Chris Smith was a player we all grew up with. And, you know, they say things happen in threes, I guess, a hat trick. But those were three incredible hockey people that and friends and family that just recently passed in the Michigan area that had so much to do with the sport early on, before we were winning Olympic gold medals and before all these young players went on to become successful. There was a core of families that meant a lot to Michigan hockey, and then obviously evolved onto bigger and greater things and still continue to give back.
Pat, so well said, and thanks for your time today talking about a dear friend of yours, a mentor, a coach, and reminding us that we're blessed when we have parents, coaches, and teachers and what they've meant in our lives. And I think our listeners will have a much better idea of Rael Turcotte's legacy, not only in Michigan, but in the United States. Thanks again, Pat.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
Okay, we're back on the Octopulse podcast with Ted Colfin. Ted, for our listeners, you have another story about the Red Wings and who they might take in the second round or third round. Lots of projection there. There are two local players. If you go to the story from the United States development team, Thomas Bordeleau and Dylan Peterson. So those are some names. And Ted, in Wednesday's paper, you have a story on a third round pick last year, Steve Yzerman's first draft, a player by the name of Albin Gru, a 19-year-old Swedish forward who will play in the OHL this year with the Saginaw Spirit. You talked to Sean Horkoff, the team's director of player development. Does this seem like a good move for Gru playing in the OHL?
Oh, yeah, a lot more games, Mark. That's the key. Mm-hmm. So many more games than playing in the Swedish Junior League. And the North American style suits his game more. He's more of a gritty, combative type. So that'll be good for him. And just it's playing against his peers. He's only 19. When you play in that Swedish men's league, you're playing against men who are darn good players. And you're not going to get, if you're 19 years old, you're not going to get much of a role there, not much ice time. So on so many levels, just playing here, it should help the kid a lot. He's still a ways away. He's a prospect. I mean, who knows if he'll ever see the light of day in the NHL, but this will be a better opportunity for him.
And you know, Ted, I remember watching a player in Saginaw that the Red Wings brought over for 1 year, Philip Ronick, who has developed well into one of the Wings cornerstones down the road on the blue line. He came over for 1 year and averaged nearly a point per game in Saginaw. So it's good for some players, like you said, who, you know, do you really want them playing against older players and getting less than 10 minutes per game, or do you want to develop someone like Ronick? And you've seen him develop into a top four defenseman.
Exactly. I mean, it's a good move. It's the premier or one of the premier junior leagues in North America. You're going to see good competition. He'll likely be playing maybe with a Cole Perfetti from Saginaw, who's going to be a top pick. So I mean, there's a lot of potential to really expand his all around game, much more so than he would in a men's league in Sweden, where he might be getting 10 minutes of ice time a game, very limited role.
So, Ted, that should wrap it up for now. The NHL preseason games, they begin next Tuesday, and then the NHL postseason gets underway with those play-in games a week from Saturday. Five games most days in that first round, beginning at noon, 2, 3, 4, 8, and 10:30 at night. And we'll be back later next week to look at those matchups. Until then, stay safe, everyone, and we'll talk to you soon, Ted.
Talk to you next week, Mark.